So today we talked to a guy named Aaron Shoemaker. Now, Aaron's a good friend of mine, but we follow this path from a kid from Michigan who ended up going to Georgetown. So when he gets to Georgetown, he learns about a bank that's run on campus. And in 4 years, he is a 22-year-old senior running a bank that has over $12 million in deposits, and he's doing it for free. He then goes to a famous place called Goldman Sachs and works his butt off for 2 years. Then he casually starts a company that is doing, you know, millions and millions of dollars of revenue. They sell that company, loses a lot of money on one bad deal, but now is like living a life that he loves, loves what he's doing, loves the people he works with. It's a wonderful path. You learn a lot from Aaron and the things that he's done and the knowledge that he has. You're going to love this episode with Aaron Shoemaker. Hey, thank you so much for joining me today. So Aaron and I got introduced by a friend of ours, Rock Sandretto, who's been a guest of the podcast. Rock's been here together with Stephen Higgins and also separately. So if you want to listen to who Rock Sandretto is, an amazing guy. He introduced me to JD, which you and JD are partners in Landex. So I really, really got to know and love Aaron the past, I don't know, probably a year. But then also, we've hung out the last couple of days together and just really dug into him. And, you know, my family got to ask him 20 questions last night in the car. And so just all those different things. So I'm excited to have you here, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Thomas. It's been super fun hanging out down here in Birmingham, Alabama.
That's right. So let's start out this way. Let's go back to growing up. So tell me about growing up in Michigan, and then just as a kid. Tell me about those things.
Yeah, for sure. So grew up, born in Michigan, mm-hmm. Detroit, Michigan. Dad's a dentist.
Okay.
Mom's a lawyer. So she actually went back to school when I was 8 to law school. So she was juggling 2 kids and decided to go back to get her law degree.
Wow.
She tells a story of when she figured out how she could get a stain out of anything, she realized it was time to go put her brain to work.
Yeah.
So I have a younger sister, and growing up, you know, we had a really loving household. Parents wanted the best for us. They wanted us to have, you know, my dad grew up, you know, his dad was a doctor. My mom grew up with nothing. And they wanted us to have a great education, great life. Education was really important. Family was really important.
When you say really important, do you mean, tell me about school. Did your parents, were they hard on school and like you got to study and what was that like?
Yeah, so school, education was super important, uh-huh. and studying, getting good grades was super important. But, you know, they loved me regardless of the outcome.
Yeah.
So, and they made sure I knew that. Sure. And that, you know, I have really good, happy memories growing up. You know, I didn't grow up in this broken home, grew up in an amazing,
right.
loving, supporting, you know, place where my parents want me to do well. They want me to have better than they had.
Yeah.
But they're there to, you know, above all, show that they love, you know, they love us.
Right. And you played tennis growing up.
Yep.
So tell me about that. Was that like, you know, when you had crazy tennis parents, or did you just play a lot, or like, cause you played tennis in college.
I did. Too. Yep.
College athlete here. So tell me about tennis growing up.
Yeah, so tennis was my thing. Mm-hmm. It was my sport. It was my outlet. I probably played, you know, 4, 5, 6 times a week. I played on the junior circuit. So we were going to tournaments all over the country. So I got to see a good part of the country.
Wow.
Playing in Texas, California, Florida. So that, you know, really bonded me and my dad. Because he was the one that would take me. You know, my mom would take me too.
Sure.
But it was a, you know, it was great bonding with both of them.
Yeah.
And I'd compete. So I'd play other, you know, other people, other juniors on the national circuit. And that was, you know, that was my thing. I was more of a keep to myself kind of guy versus have a, you know, have 5 or 6 close friendships versus have, you know, 1,000.
Sure.
1,000 folks. So I played a bunch of sports growing up, but tennis is what I really gravitated towards because I loved the, you know, I love the challenge. And,
yeah.
you know, it was up to me whether I did it or not.
Oh, it's the ultimate, you know, yeah. individual sport. So going from high school, transitioning into college. So a question I always like to ask people is this: junior high, high school, so and so came up to you. Hey, Aaron, what do you want to be when you grow up? What did you say?
So I was thinking about this. You gave me a little plant.
I did.
This question was coming.
Yeah.
I thought it was from the lens of when I was like 2, 3, 4. I'll give that answer. You know, my parents have this, I think it's either a story they tell or a photo they've got of me playing with like this, you know, Fisher Price cash register.
Oh yeah.
When I was like 2 years old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they tell me, I always said I wanted to be some sort of banker, and you know, that was, they had, my mom told a story of, you know, I was counting the change out by the time I was 2 to go on the bus. So I always had an acumen for numbers.
Yeah.
And that translated later into an acumen for opportunity. But when I was in junior high, high school, I didn't think about this one, but yeah, I wanted to go into business. So I didn't know what,
yeah.
I didn't know where, you know, I guess I remember doing an internship for a mutual fund company when I was a senior that, you know, they required us to do it. This might've been my junior year. Forget which, but I was doing this internship for a mutual fund company, and I thought, hey, I want to be a mutual fund manager.
Really? Yeah,
that's what'll do it. And this was probably fleeting, sure. Like three months or so, but
yeah.
I really wanted to, you know, grew up in an affluent town. You know, we were never for want for anything, but
yeah.
we grew up in the automotive capital of the world, Michigan.
Yeah,
you had,
sure.
You know, the folks that started all the car companies, mm-hmm. and their descendants that lived. So I was just kind of enamored with those stories of, how did this get created? And, you know, so I didn't know what the word entrepreneur went, but
yeah.
I wanted to go into business, but I knew I wanted to go into business for myself.
So you knew it, like junior high school, like I'll probably never work for somebody.
I didn't know if I would do it. So I had this urge that would be cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know the path or the steps. So I think it had been planted.
Yeah.
And once I got into college, you know, I had, you know, the path I saw for me was I'm going to go work on Wall Street, work for Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. which I ended up doing, and that would be my path.
Right.
But, yeah, that was college. So it was an ever-evolving thing for how I ended up getting to, you know, where I ended
what
up
you do today.
Getting entrepreneurially.
Yeah. So what made your decision? So you graduate from high school, you go to Georgetown.
Yep.
Very prestigious school. Academically, tell me why Georgetown.
I had two cousins that went there, and they always came back. You know, they were older, maybe 5, 6, 7 years older.
Yeah.
And they would always come back with these amazing stories of, you know, just loving it. So I was kind of predisposed to, you know, just thinking it'd be a really cool place to go to school.
Sure.
And then, you know, it was a place I could play tennis. So the team was D1. They were good.
Did you get a scholarship to play tennis?
Nope.
Didn't get a scholarship.
Nope. Didn't get a scholarship.
But you got to walk on, which is.
No, I was going to play there. So,
yeah.
You know, everybody has to try out every single mm-hmm. year. So it wasn't a walk on, I was going to do it, but
yeah,
I think they only had one scholarship for the whole team.
Oh
so
my God.
It was, you know, wasn't a huge, they're basketball school. They're not a tennis school.
Sure, sure. Okay. So you go there, play tennis for a year. What did you start out wanting to do? Like when I went to college, I knew I was going to coach college football. Like I was there to play ball and to go get a degree,
yep.
so I could go coach. Like that was predisposed like to me.
Yep.
What did you want to do? Like I want to go into this. What was your thought there?
I'm pretty quick to pick up on pretty quick and pretty slow to pick up on opportunity.
Yeah.
I can get back to what the slow part is, but again, knew I wanted to build a path. So
right.
build a path for my future, for, you know, just had this drive to create wealth, to, you know, to, when I started as a freshman, you know, get an amazing job.
Mm-hmm.
So I land on campus, you know, and probably within 4 days, you know, one of the new friendships I made was a girl I was pursuing.
It always starts with a girl.
Yep. Yep. So she was going to this credit union thing, and I'd seen all these flyers that were all across campus that were literally littered all across campus for come work at the credit union. You know, it's your ticket to Wall Street. It's literally that's what the flyer said. You know, our interns that work here go to work at Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, Bain, Morgan Stanley. Mm. And if you come work here, you can do that. I had no idea what any of that meant.
Right.
But it, you know, it was kind of prestigious and there was an aura or an air around it. So I was like, all right, I'll go check this thing out. And, you know, that sort of chance encounter with, you know, going to this credit union to learn about it one night pursuing this girl turned into basically, you know, my entrepreneurial path.
Yeah.
So I started working at this credit union, which is a student run bank on Georgetown's campus. They've got probably 6,000 or 7,000 members. At the time they had about 85% of Georgetown students that were their membership base. At the time it was like 11 or 12 million of customer deposits. They made loans and it was run entirely by students. So
let me make sure I understand this. So we've got a freshman in college, this whole staff at this quote unquote bank. The difference in a bank and a credit union is a bank is for profit. A credit union is not for profit. A credit union is members.
Yep.
But in essence, it is the same thing.
Yep.
Banks and credit unions, same thing.
Same services.
So you are 18, 19 years old. You are working at this bank along with other college students working at this bank. There is zero supervision.
Yep.
And you are
Zero adult supervision.
Zero adult supervision.
Quote unquote adult. We're obviously all adults, but zero supervision outside of the, you know, freshmen, outside of the seniors who were running the place at the time.
Right.
Fully regulated, so it was regulated by the NCUA. So I guess the adult supervision,
yeah,
you know, was our annual audit that they'd come in and do on us. But I, you know, took this meeting this one night, probably 5 or 6 days, or went to this event 5 or 6 days into freshman year, and it became my whole. You know, it revolved around most of my college experience. Most of my best friends came from this place. So I was playing tennis, was working at this bank, you know, as we called it the bank, probably 30, 35 hours a week, not paid. So it was all unpaid.
So everybody that works at this bank is unpaid?
Unpaid, yep.
This is brilliant. Like, no one's making any money because it's a credit union,
yep.
But it's brilliant because you've got 100 and something people that are working and having crap ton of experience.
Yep.
That get to pay, you know, a path to go to the next level.
And the recruiting was great. It was, you know, join the credit union, your ticket to Wall Street. And it literally was your ticket to Wall Street because you know, you're coming up on interviews for the best jobs. All the, you know, the top firms come to recruit on campus and you got to have something to talk about. You know, it's not like,
yeah.
You know, impressing them that, hey, teaching tennis, I did that. You know, made a lot more money teaching tennis than I did working at the credit union. But that, you know, that story, it's not a story that's really going to resonate. But
yeah.
I can captivate somebody when I can tell a story about, hey, you know, I'm dealing with this time that somebody cashed an $80,000 check and it was fraudulent. So I got to deal with that. So,
yeah,
you know, wow. I wasn't the one directly dealing with this, but it was on my watch. You know, the FBI was involved. I think the Secret Service was somehow involved in, you know, trying to figure out who is this guy that was doing check kiting. So,
wow.
You know, you learn all the different skills of being, you know, a leader of an organization at
yeah.
an age where you never would be in that position otherwise. So you're basically like taking time, you know, if you're working in an organization, you're climbing the corporate ladder, it's going to be at least 10 years, probably more like 15 or 20 where you're put in the position of being CEO. You know, you can do it in 4, and you can do it in college. So it's basically like a foreshadowing for what's to come in yeah. real business. And it was, you know, it's cheat code.
So the model of this bank is you start as a freshman, as a teller, and then you progressively work up as you stay with it. So there
yep.
are other people that do it for a couple of years and then stop. And there are people that go all 4 years.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like a little bit like a pledge class. Like you'll come in as a bunch of tellers,
yeah.
people will be interested. You'll have people who drop out, a couple people, you know, once they go abroad, study abroad was a big thing of, are you going to keep going at the bank or are you going to go abroad? And for me, it was, you know, no question. I'm staying here.
Stay at the bank.
I want to be CEO of this thing my senior
yeah.
year. So, you know, worked my freshman, the summer after my freshman year, worked there, And I was just like, for some reason I felt it. Like, this is my path. I'm doing this and I'm going all in.
No fraternity. Sports were not a thing. You went to school and worked at the bank.
Yeah. And I played tennis my freshman year, yeah. But, you know, at the end of it realized, hey, I can't do both.
Sure.
I can't do both and be great.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to be a professional tennis player. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to teach tennis professionally. Mm-hmm. That's not my career and my path. So this is it. And I'm going all in over here.
What's the number one thing you learned in running a bank while being in college?
Bet you'd never thought you'd ask that question before.
Never, ever.
I don't know what that question is a hard one to answer on the spot. What's the number one thing? But I'll tell you what comes up when I'm asked that question. You got to think on your feet. Like, business, you know, you can have the best business plan. Like, I'll give you an example of thinking on your feet. So my senior year, I was CEO. And over the summer, I was doing my internship at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
So, you know, working crazy hours around the clock. And I get this call from the you know, the interns that were there for the summer. So this place can't shut down during the summer. So you've got to keep going. So you have three interns that will work there. One will be a teller, one will do operations, one will do member service, and they got to keep the whole thing going.
Yeah.
So I get this call. I remember I was walking down the West Side Highway, and I think it was Ankit, who was one of the guys that was running the place, or Allison maybe, said, hey, Chevy Chase Bank is opening a branch on campus this fall. I was like, what? How can this happen? And they're literally opening a branch. So a real bank coming in to sort of take away our monopoly. And
yeah.
Georgetown had a monopoly because we were in the, you know, it was like when you're a freshman, you just do what
everybody else does.
We had a flyer that was in there. We tell them to, you know, go sign up on the website, go open your account, and they do it. But now Chevy Chase is coming. Like, they're a real bank. They've got probably billions of customer deposits.
Yeah.
So you got to learn how to think on your feet. So first reaction was, oh man, this thing's going down on my watch. Mm. You know, that's the initial reaction is like the fear gets you.
Yeah.
And then the next reaction was, wait, no, like this is our territory. This is our turf. We know this turf better than anybody else. Like, I, you know, just because they're opening a branch doesn't mean the demise of the credit union. Yeah. Fast forward, you know, 15, however many years it's been since, the credit union has not had a demise. So that's the awesome end story. But the learning was, you know, you're going to get punched in the gut and you got to get back up.
Wow.
And that was an example of being punched in the gut. And the story for how we survived based on our members. Yeah. So, you know, they had a couple booths. So you get all your new customers in one weekend. It's when it's called open account weekend at the credit union.
Yeah.
Or for everybody else, it's called, you know, going to school weekend. And you got to capture all those freshmen right then and there. So we got the mailers and some people signed up during the summer, but you got to be in the right places to, you know, get people to sign up.
Them.
And if it looks like this is just the next thing they're supposed to do, then it's the next thing they're supposed to do. So they had, I think, three or four people that were there.
Chase?
Chevy Chase Bank.
Yeah.
So they had a couple booths and they positioned themselves. They were giving good access.
You call it Chevy Chase Bank.
Yeah.
Is that just like a stick? Like,
no, that's the,
is it Chevy Chase?
There's Bank? Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Yeah.
Which I don't think has anything to do with the actual actor.
Yeah.
So it's not his.
Okay.
Bank.
I'm like, what is this? Okay. All right. So Chevy. Okay. So yep. Back to your story. Sorry.
So probably good clarification there. So they've got three or four booths set up in prime locations. Cause they're paying big money to open this bank here, probably doing, you know, big donations, but what did we have that they didn't? We had an army. So anywhere they would go, we'd have like three booths that were outside. And they were moving around and they were clearly getting frustrated. And we had like 150 people. So we were just literally playing tactical warfare to get students open account weekend. So, and that was just a total example of like, hey, what can we, you know, how can we outcompete these guys?
How can we combat this?
You know, they have to pay their people.
Yeah.
All our people are here loving it.
We love it.
You know, we're going to go party tonight after and celebrate
all
the...
sign up all these kids.
Yep.
So you graduate from college and get a job at Goldman Sachs. So the name Goldman Sachs, I did not know the name probably until about 4 or 5 years ago, to believe it or not, just because I haven't been in that world. How did you get that job?
Lots of interviews.
Really?
And I totally wanted to work there. So it was like the...
But why? Why did you, as a 22-year-old, again, we grew up differently and we had different thoughts, especially when I was 22. Why did you want to go work at Goldman Sachs?
So I didn't know what Goldman Sachs was until I got to Georgetown.
Okay.
I knew there was some sort of aura around it, or some sort of air of like, you know, you go here and like, you know, you've got a success path that you just, you know, you're on.
Yeah.
And those flyers that I was talking about were probably the first impression of what's that. The guy who was running the credit union my senior year, who had become my business partner in Front Point, had a job at Goldman Sachs. And you know, he was kind of big man on campus, yeah, running this bank, having this job at Goldman Sachs. And, you know, the truth of it is like, hey, this is, you know, this guy's a role model. This guy, you know, runs this credit union like it's a Fortune 500 company.
Sure.
At least that's what it felt like to me. So I wanted that. And it was very easy to, you know, to see it in a picture of like, hey, if in 4 years I can do that, you know, it's just a real clear path. So I wanted it, you know, super bad. So how'd I get the job? Tons of interviews. And I realized that most of the hires they make, they'll do an internship during the summer. And then I thought, you know, what if I could do an internship my sophomore summer instead of my junior summer?
So
I worked at the bank, this credit union, my freshman summer, you know, because oftentimes you got to work there during the summer to end up being CEO. So I sped that process up because typically it's sophomore summer, and then applied to a group that was not the ultimate group I wanted to be in. So there's, there's revenue producing and then there's operations. I was more in an operational group.
Okay.
And applied to that, and you know, I prepped hard for these interviews. Yeah. I learned to tell stories. I learned to make them authentic, and just kept repeating and repeating and repeating, so I could basically take any of the questions. You know, I asked people around, what are the questions that I'm likely to be asked? And I went deep on that to make sure, hey, I'm not sounding scripted. I've got a story I can pull out for whatever the question is, and it ended up being about storytelling, and that's what I was coached, and you know, got that job because I nailed the interviews.
Where did you learn how to do that though? Like, well, who taught you all these interview skills? Like, this sounds like this was a class, or this was like, I mean, like,
yeah, my friend who is running the credit union.
Gotcha.
It's people. Like, you want something, go find somebody who's doing it.
He's doing it. Like, yep. Yesterday.
Yeah, we met with David.
Yeah.
He's doing multifamily. We had tons of conversations about multifamily. He's been doing it for 25 years. So
yeah.
I'm not going to learn anywhere near as much as I'm going to learn from him about a book, from a book.
Yeah.
You know, that being said, YouTube videos and books, like, you can immerse yourself in all that. But if you're sitting in front of somebody who's done it, how'd you do it?
Well, yeah. Like yesterday, we sat there for 2 hours with him and asked him, you know, question after question after question. Some of them were, you know, small questions. Some of them were big picture questions. So, okay, makes sense. So, if my kid, if Tegan came to me and said, "Dad, what's Goldman Sachs?" I would not have an answer. What is Goldman Sachs?
It's a lot of things, but it's an investment bank.
Okay.
So what that means?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
So they help. So David helped. You know, his career was buying and selling buildings.
Right.
Goldman is helping buy and sell companies. They're helping advise companies on anything, you know, financial, many things strategic,
okay,
relating to their finances. So that's one part. Another part is they manage other people's money. So
like a Morgan Stanley or a Merrill Lynch.
Yep.
Okay.
And then another part is they trade for their own account. At least they did when I was there. So
yeah,
they're making investments for Goldman shareholders. It's publicly traded. So
company.
they will, you know, parts of their firm will make bets or investments in companies that they believe they can, you know, help grow, but sure, also make a return on.
What did you do there?
I helped raise money for...
Go back. I'm going to ask this question again. What did you do when you worked at Goldman Sachs?
Sure. So I'll give the answer for what my group did and then what I did. So what my group did was we helped private equity firms, so investment companies that were buying operating companies.
Okay.
We helped them raise the debt financing to do their transactions.
Help them raise the debt financing.
So they have equity. They raised equity money from all their investors.
Yep.
And they needed debt. So when they buy a company, let's say they buy a company for $1 billion, they'll use $300 million of their own money and they'll use $700 million of other people's money. It's just like buying a house.
So they'll use $300 million
yep.
from individual investors, Thomas Cox, Aaron Shoemaker.
The private equity firm, yep. Yeah, or and pension then, funds. Or.
And then they'll take $700 million.
Of somebody else's debt.
Of debt, and will it be a bank?
So Goldman, it could be a bank, or it could be, you know, other people, you know, much like you who
sure.
want debt investments. So that could be a vehicle that's basically you invested over here and it ends up being loaned out to, you know, the private equity firm as they're buying this company.
What did you do at Goldman when you worked there?
Whatever they asked me to.
So I've got two questions here.
As the low man on the totem pole.
So the first thing is, what did you do when you worked at Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, so I'll give you more specifics. The primary job was running the financial models. So they'd have these elaborate, massively complicated Excel sheets. And as I look back, like they end up getting simplified. So for whoever you're working it for, you deal with all the detail. You figure it out. You figure out how to program it into the spreadsheet and project out, you know, is this, what are the returns going to be to the investor?
Mm.
That's important. And then, you know, most important for my group was we're raising the debt financing. So, you know, what does the debt package look like? So so my job was running the financial model and making the presentation.
The financial model. Okay. So in essence, what we're doing today with Landex and with like what David Oakley does.
I learned it there.
Very, very similar models, just on a different scale.
Different scale, but same concept. So at Landex, we're buying land to make a profit on the land.
Mm-hmm.
So our particular model is to buy it, subdivide it, so sell it for... you know, cut it up into smaller chunks. And when you cut it up into smaller chunks, it's just based on the comps, it's worth more per acre.
Sure.
Not all land suitable for it, but you find land that's suitable for it. There's debt. So when we buy this thing, let's say we're using 65-70% debt, just like at Goldman, we'd use, you know, 65-70% debt. We would bring 30% equity. So the private equity firm would have some of their own money in there.
Yep.
Like all the partners' money, so some of our own money is in there, you know, skin in the game, and then you're raising money from other people to, you know, deliver them a return passively in an instrument that we believe fully in. It was literally doing the same thing.
So this is just another investment vehicle for people. So you have the stock market where you put money in the stock market, and if this particular Apple stock. If Apple stock grows, you make money because the value goes up. Here, you instead of giving $100,000 in the market and doing that, in a fund like this, you give $100,000 and Landex says, this is going to pay 10%. Good round number. This is going to pay 10% per year. Let's just say that. And so what happens is I give the money to the fund, and then over the course of the year, I will make 10% on my money. So at the end of the year, I have $110,000. That's the elementary way to say.
I'll clarify a little bit
because
I think it's important. So you'll give me $100,000. What we're targeting and what we're trying to do is to buy the land, cut it up into pieces, and deliver you, you know, every, this isn't promise, like not making,
yeah, can't. Yeah,
here's all the disclosure. Everybody has to make their own investment decisions, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. Got that covered. But we're looking to deliver a 25 to 30% return in 12 to 18 months to the investor. So right. Buy this land for $1 million, sell it for $1.5 million, or thereabouts. And you know, that there's plenty in there to deliver a 25 to 30% return to invest, you know, anybody who put cash in, that's where our target is. And hopefully we overperform.
Sure. Let's go back to, because I want to get back to LandX. I want to dig deep into that. Tell me about, because last night we were in the car and you mentioned, or this morning you mentioned the amount of hours that you worked when you were there. You worked there for 2 years?
Yep.
2 years. Give me an idea of why do you have to work so much at a place like that?
It's just, I mean, so there's a quote, money loves speed.
Mm-hmm.
At Goldman, you know, the pace is extremely quick. Part of why Goldman has the reputation they do is they're a service firm, among other things. They yeah. deliver a service to a client, and those clients, you know, can be on the brink of a major breakthrough that they need money for quickly, mm-hmm. or they've got a deal that has a timeline, and if you know, and they need financing for it, or they need, you know, merger advice, that those timelines, you know, don't work 9 to 5.
Mm.
Those timelines work on whatever timelines that their business needs. So if Goldman, as an example, is going to be great at client service and they're going to win, they need to be serving the client. So my job, you know, my job there was to help make the models, make the presentations, you know, be available to do all that, because the senior partner who has all these relationships, who's been through my shoes all the way up, he needs this information. You know, he needs it very easily digestible, because he's running, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10, 15 deals. He's got hundreds of he or she has hundreds of relationships, and they need the info.
They want the info faster than normal.
They need the info faster than normal. And if you're, you know, in that world, and that world is certainly not for everybody.
Sure.
It just starts out as a grind. Like,
how many hours did you work a week?
You know, it varied. So yeah. When their deals were heavy, it could be well into the 100 hour plus per week. And then there were slower times where it was 70, 80
hours a week is a slow time. Got it.
Yep.
So you did this for how long?
About 2 years.
2 years. And then what happened?
So all the while, in the time we didn't have...
Hang on 1 second. Let me ask this again. So why did you leave Goldman Sachs?
Because I wanted to build a business. I wanted to run something for myself.
Mm.
And I left at that age because at the time I thought, hey, this is a great career path, but there's golden handcuffs that start to happen here, that... You start doing well, you start doing even more well, you start doing incredibly well, you start doing absurdly well. Once you're on that path, it becomes hard to step off the treadmill.
Because you're making so much darn money.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So what did you do when you left Goldman Sachs?
I'll back up to a little bit of the story.
Yeah.
So Chris, my business partner at FrontPoint, I left Goldman Sachs and started a DIY home security company called FrontPoint.
Mm-hmm.
It started with, you know, we just want to build a business. And we were seeing all sorts of different business models. It's just what we did.
Yeah.
So we were thinking of all sorts of different ideas. And they sparked ideas. So it's not like we were, you know, going to go copy this and do that. But you're just exposed to so much business that if you're wanting to start something, you know, I'm a dot connector. So I see this thing over there, I see that thing over here, and it all just kind of comes together for me for, hey, we can connect this and that and this and that. And,
sure.
You know, as an example, I won't go into the detail, but there are some things we were talking about this weekend where, or this, you know, this time together where, hey, you pull this person together, you know, you talk to that guy and, you know, maybe there's something there.
Right.
I don't know. No idea. So we were coming up with different businesses we could start. We probably had I don't know, 15 or 20 different ideas. We went deep and wrote business plans on a couple of them. Almost left to start a Fast Change Oil.
Yeah.
You know, like a Jiffy Lube. Didn't end up doing that. And ultimately decided to start this DIY home security company called, you know, it would end up being being called Front Point.
So let me hear, let me back up and make sure I understand what you're saying. You didn't have a thing that you absolutely loved and pursued that thing. You put together the dots of what you thought would be successful and what you were good at.
There were commonalities for the ideas that came up.
Okay. What were they?
Taking one step back, I wanted to build a business. I wanted to run my own business. That was the canvas upon which we were painting. That was the idea.
So here's the thing.
That's where it started.
Here's where everybody, I think, gets screwed up. Okay. This is just an opinion. If you think I'm wrong, just tell me I'm wrong. We're close enough. You can tell me that. You hear there's so much stuff out there that people say to follow your passion. I think that's a load of crap, to be honest with you. But I think that your passion here was to own your own business and start a business. Was that your passion? It wasn't like home security was not your passion or quick change oil. Your desire, what kept you up at night, was owning your own and starting your own business.
Yes. So I totally agree that follow your passion can be a platitude or it can be real. Like different people are different things, but I'll tell you my story. It wasn't my passion. It was my desire. It was my burning desire to be successful and own a business. So we had this blank canvas that we could paint on, and it's called Create a Great Business. And that's literally where it started. So the original iteration of it, it's funny. It comes all the way, you know, full circle back to what I'm doing now. It's basically private equity. First idea was to start a private equity firm. I had no idea what that meant, but private equity firms, we were talking, you know, the Forbes list, there are so many people that are hedge fund. Private equity.
Yeah.
You know, those are, so that was the original idea. You have no idea what it actually means, but the people who have gone on to do this have been super successful. So, hey, why don't I follow that path?
Yeah. So you just had a desire to do a business.
Yep.
So give me an example of some of those things that were like really the top three of what you started a DIY home security system. What were the top three things that you guys were considering starting?
That Fast Change Oil
company.
And then there was another one. Actually, there was this company called Cosmo.
Okay.
I mean, very obscure at this point. It didn't make it. It, you know, probably would have made it. Might have made it if it didn't get caught up in the dot-com bubble crash. So this thing was around in 1999, 2000, and they would deliver you whatever you wanted within 30 minutes. You want a can of Coke, they deliver it. So that sounds a lot like Uber Eats.
Yeah.
Sounds a lot like DoorDash.
Yeah.
So we went down that path. We were going to start it in Boston, and it was going to be a better version of Cosmo. We thought Cosmo had no reason to fail.
Yeah.
You know, except... Yeah, circumstances that were market-based. And so we were going to create this convenience business, kind of like Uber Eats. And then the thing that stopped us was like, literally the thing that stopped us was, man, we're going to have to buy like a huge commercial refrigerator. Those things aren't cheap.
No. Out.
Yep.
So that's what kept you from doing it.
I think so. I think it was also too early. Like that was one of the first ideas that we came up with.
Yeah.
Wrote a business plan, built models about, it was too early. Like we refined it as we went. And the commonalities as I look back were something that can scale.
Yep.
Something that has to do with technology. Like technology is a component. So that goes a little bit hand in hand with scale. And something that we could just deliver amazing customer service with. So my philosophy in starting Front Point was don't worry about the money. Like you take care of the customer, you deliver a 12 out of 5 star customer experience, you build a product that, you know, hey, it's not going to be perfect. Nothing is, but if something goes wrong, we got you.
I think sometimes though, Aaron, when things go wrong, it's not bad because when things go wrong,
you get an opportunity.
It gives you an opportunity to fix it and go above and beyond. Like you said, a 12 star experience, 12 out of 5 star experience. And if I can deliver If I screw something small up,
yep,
but over deliver on the back end, that gets people's attention.
Yeah, it's actually like, hey, they don't think about the mistake. They think about, hey, I was talking to this person who helped solve my problem. They were really friendly.
Yeah.
You know, it even took them an hour, or it took them, you know, 45 minutes. I didn't have 45 minutes, but they kept me entertained.
Yeah.
You know, they just did little things to make me feel like they got me.
The mistakes are all, a lot of times mistakes are not mistakes. They're opportunities to do something great. And we have to view that in everything that we do.
We never did this, but I often thought like, hey, you know, maybe we should plant a mistake, you know, not a big one, but show how we deal with things that go awry. We didn't do that, by the way, but
tell me about Front Point. Give me the 90-second version of like what Front Point was and how you did that.
Front Point was DIY home security, home alarm system.
Yep.
So what that means is regular alarm system.
Yep.
Somebody breaks into your house, we call the police. A fire happens, we call the fire department, because we have in your home installed devices to detect a break-in, detect a flood, detect a fire. And when we started Front Point, this technology was built by other people. We didn't build this to control your home, you know, your home security system from a computer. At the time, the iPhone was just coming out. The App Store wasn't out yet.
Right.
So you could control it from your BlackBerry.
and
nobody was using this technology. So there was an opportunity to do that. And then there was also an opportunity, like the technology for the security system was to a place where you didn't need techs and trucks all across the country. And that was one of the big barriers to scale for other companies is we have to have all these people. We have to have all these techs. We have to send them to people's house. So you had all these companies that were regionally based. You had maybe two or three, maybe, you know, you had two players maybe that were nationwide and the rest was not. So we had a model that we could do this all from one location, send it to you as the customer. We would walk you through how to set it up.
Customer service. We would
do most of it, you know, we would do most of it in-house where we would pre-program the thing. So basically you take it out of the box, you put up a door sensor, you put up a window sensor, you put up a motion sensor. Here's the, you know, the quick start guide for how to do it. And in most cases, 20 to 30 minutes and you're done.
How long did you own that company? How long did you own Front Point?
2007 to 2020. And I'm still a small owner after we sold. So about 12, yeah, a little over a decade.
When you owned it for those 10 years, what was revenue the last year that you owned it around?
$125 million.
$125 million, and that was mostly subscriptions.
Yeah, we had somewhere around 250,000 individual subscribers that would. So they would buy the security system from us, and that was a small piece of the revenue. And then the big piece of revenue, and this was part of the, like, we engineered a business model.
Sure.
Part of the business model engineering was they'll show up and they'll pay us every month. So we had, you know, it was a little under $10 million of. $10 million of monthly recurring revenue.
So not bad.
And it's, you know, 250,000 people that pay you 40 some odd dollars a month to monitor their, you know, monitor their homes and in some case businesses.
When you decided to, did you decide to sell or did someone come to you and want to buy?
So all along we had suitors. So we had, you know, people who were reaching, private equity firms that were reaching out to us.
And all along?
For the longest time, it was a no. Not for sale. Not for sale.
Okay.
Not for sale. Not for sale. Like, not interested.
All right.
So we were probably branded as the not for sale.
Yeah.
Not interested. As I look back, we should have cultivated those relationships.
Sure.
And, you know, thought, hey, maybe we should entertain it. And part of why is one of my mentors said the best thing we ever did was we went to market every single year. And they would tell us from their perspective, what can you do different to increase value? You know, it would be an outside
That's
lens.
That's great.
So remind you, we owned almost 100% of the company. Like we didn't.
You and your partner.
Me and my partner, 100% of the common equity. We had angel investors who invested in us, and then we had a ton of debt. We had several hundred million of debt. So we woke up one day, this was in 2017, and said, I want to sell.
Mm.
And then it was...
Why? Why did you want to sell?
We worked so hard. We were burned out.
Yeah, sure.
So we worked so hard for so long. It was just time. Yeah. It was time and we were ready and we thought we would own it forever. Mm. As we, you know, 2010, 2011, we were building something that we literally thought we would own forever. And there's something to be said for owning something forever, and there's also something said for having a, you know, plan B.
Yeah.
So we got to that point and, you know, and then it was a 3-year process.
3 years?
Yeah. We went to market. We hired an investment bank. We didn't hire Goldman, but we hired an investment bank to help sell us. We went through a process spent probably 9 or 10 months getting ready. That was way too long. We should have done it a lot faster. And then we went to market, and we were down to, you know, one bidder at the end, basically. You know, there were two bidders, started with like hundreds of potential firms, and you narrow down to there's 30 people that are interested, and then you hold presentations with you. We narrow it down to 10 people we want to meet with. We go through basically like day-long presentations with them, and it's just this funnel that gets you down to, you know, hopefully you've got a bidding war at the end. We were trying to create a bidding war, but you know, there was a bunch of stuff that happened, like Amazon bought Ring. That was a competitor. So there are these things that happen in a sale process that like will scare potential buyers. So this is where having multiple options and multiple paths and basically being indifferent to, hey, if I don't care if I go this way or this way, you're in a good spot. So ultimately we were this close to selling in 2018, and then the 11th hour it just fell apart. So we were working for about a year and a half, you know, about to have more money than I'd ever seen in my my life, and then it just kind of unravels. So then we went back.
Let me stop for a second. At $125 million in revenue, were you living, would you have considered yourself, quote, rich? Were you making a lot of money, like, yourself?
Yeah, I would certainly consider myself, I don't like using that word.
Sure, but wealthy. You would have considered, with you guys having that much in revenue, you would consider you and your partner, y'all were wealthy, y'all were making a good salary, having good distributions, things like that.
Yep.
Okay. So this deal fell apart.
Yep.
What happens next? Did you just immediately hop back on the bandwagon and go, who's next?
No, I mean, that takes the wind out of your, certainly takes the wind out of your sails. So we went back and we fixed things in the business that, you know, we learned from the process needed to be broken. And then, you know, it took us another 2 years to get back to market and ultimately sold.
Who did you sell to? Can you say?
Twin Point Capital. So we sold to a private equity firm.
Okay. When you sell to a private equity firm, Twin Point Capital, what does that process look like? How long did you work there after the money was wired to your account?
So we had hired a CEO. So when the process sort of ended in 2018. With the other company. Yep.
Yeah.
We hired we promoted our COO to be CEO. So we moved to the chairman role.
Okay.
And we were working on the business, not in the business. And then, you know, so at that point we were essentially no longer in the day to day. So once the private equity firm bought, you know, they didn't really need us because we'd already built a business that we could transition and we could sell. So that was pretty much that. On closing day, we're not really involved.
Give me two things you learned. What are the two most important things you learned that you were doing wrong in your business before you sold?
I'd say the outcome coulda, woulda, shoulda, but the outcome would have been better if we were growing like a rocket ship.
Mm.
And at that point in time, we thought we would own this thing forever and, you know, the business would never have anything to contend with. Like,
right.
Kind of like Chevy Chase Bank coming to Georgetown, like Ring creating their system, was definitely a disruption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 2018 deal, but what did I learn? Be open to pivot. So be open to alternative, you know, be open to, don't be so dead set on your path that you are blind to other,
sure,
other alternatives.
Yeah.
For what we built, probably would have diversified earlier. So bring in, you know, even if it was a 20% partner, 15% partner, I think that external, you know, somebody with external skin in the game would have been a helpful push, because we prided ourselves on being independent and basically creating this thing with owning 100% of it or close to it. And I think that kind of created a little bit of an echo chamber, and
yeah,
you know, we're
not seeing the forest for the trees.
Yeah. Or just, you know, sort of drinking your own Kool-Aid. And so the two things I would learn are be open to alternative paths, meaning, hey, I'm going this way, but I see an opportunity over here. And the second would have probably been, I'd say I'd probably boil a lot of it down to that. Yeah. And then I'd say earlier on, find a way to not get burned out.
What did you do when you sold? What were you sold? You guys are out of a job, get a check. What'd you do for that? What was the next 6 months like?
So the next 6 months, my partner and I did different things. So we kind of took different paths after the exit. I was kind of hard charging to go essentially become a family office or build a private equity firm of my own, buy small businesses, got bit by the real estate big bug, reasonably hard.
Yeah.
So I was going hard at what's next, and just, I didn't really take any time.
Mm.
And maybe that was to cover up, hey, I've got this big void for this huge business we created, and my way of, you know, processing all of it was just go dive right in and
yeah,
work on act two or act three or act whatever it was.
So what was act two?
Act two is what I'm kind of doing now.
Yeah.
So act two is, so we've got Landex.
Yep.
So Landex is essentially a private equity firm where we buy land, do very simple subdivision development on it, and then sell the land. So it's a commercial venture. So we're in service of our LPs or our investors.
Yep.
You know, take that stewardship extremely importantly, where we're looking to buy a plot, you know, do the subdivision development, turn it around for 25 to 30% returns in 12 to 18 months. So that's one thing. And the other is building businesses. So I thought I was going to go buy one, but ended up starting one instead.
Tell me about that.
So we were looking for an operating business. So, and this is advice I give a lot of people.
Okay.
So I'm sure if you're in the circle and you're following entrepreneurial stuff and you're
listening, this is for you.
Yep. I'm a huge fan of the Cody Sanchez model.
Okay.
What I call it. It's been around forever. So private equity.
She's just made it popular.
Yeah. Yep. Made it super popular. So I'm a huge fan of the Cody Sanchez model, which is basically private equity.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing is buying a business that already exists. So what we did with FrontPoint was we created something that didn't exist.
Mm.
The risk level is kind of through the roof.
Sure.
Like, as I look back at all the points of potential failure, like we were 3 weeks away from missing payroll and we had to raise $1.5 million in 3 weeks. Like, or we ended up raising $1 million. We didn't need that much, but we raised that. So the risk level where you're just sort of leaving your job and taking blind faith that, you know, I'm going to do this. It is for some people.
Yeah.
Like some people have such strong conviction, or some people have done something for so long that I'm just going to go do this on my own because I know it. What we did was, you know, ignorance was definitely bliss. Mm. Like if I had known all the potential pitfalls and paths, and if my 24 year old brain had developed a little bit more of the mature,
you would have done something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but the advice I would give, long-winded way of saying, the advice I would give is look for something that already exists. Don't necessarily look for something that, you know, it's the first thing you can find, but if you build relationships.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the biggest thing. Everything comes back. So many things just come back to relationships. Like,
they do.
You and I have talked about this in the past. Like, what business can we buy that already exists where there is an owner who is looking to sell, who can maybe even finance it? So your out of pocket is maybe even zero. I mean, that's kind of like the golden goose scenario. That it does exist, but
it's just difficult.
Yep. More likely you're getting an SBA loan and you're pulling some money together.
A lot of money from people.
And it's a process. But if you had that desire that I want to own my own business, it's a much less risky way to go do it, because you got something that's been in existence for 10 years is much more likely to be existence next year and the year after and the year after. And you've got all these people and processes that are already built. You should want to take it to here. But so what I'm doing now is, I'm looking for opportunities like that. But what I feel like I've actually done is create things from scratch.
So something we hadn't talked about yet is you bought a franchise. Okay. What made you want to buy a franchise? Was it this? Like this thought?
The thought was go buy an existing business. And we were diligencing existing businesses.
Yeah.
And we came across a PuroClean, actually in Birmingham, Alabama. Nice. Of all places.
Yeah.
Of all places. The thing was for sale here.
Perfect.
Didn't actually make the trip down here to look at it. We were looking at numbers from afar. Decided we loved the business model. We loved PuroClean. We didn't want that particular business. It was a little too small. I mean, as you get into small business diligence, it's tricky. Because they may not be trying to hide something, but the record keeping isn't what we were accustomed to. So, you're literally pulling bank statements and putting in an Excel spreadsheet to verify what they're telling you. So anyway, long story short, we loved the business model, like floods and fires for PuroClean. For people who don't know what that is, it's a property restoration company.
Right.
Where they come in and you have a flood or a fire or mold. We come in, we clean it up, extract the water, dry it out, do it so that there's no mold that will grow.
Right.
So that's called remediation. We'll do that. And then we'll put it back together, because we'll have to rip out cabinets. We'll have to rip out carpet to make sure that everything's treated properly. So we fell in love with this model because it just happens. Like, it's not going to be disrupted by Amazon. It's not going to be disrupted by AI. You're still going to need a human, at least, for the
at least now.
Very foreseeable future. You're going to need a human to rip out the carpet. You're going to need a human to have judgment for, I need to do this. I don't need to do that. AI can certainly help, and we're leveraging as many of the technology tools as we can possibly leverage to make our job, to be more competitive, to save money, to save time, to save efficiency. But we love the business model because that stuff just happens, and it's not just floods. It's like your dishwasher detaches from the wall, and all of a sudden it floods your basement. Like, that stuff happens actuarially.
All the time.
So
tell me about how you compete with SurfPro. Is that your number one competitor?
They're a competitor.
Yeah. Because your franchise is in Atlanta, correct? Yep. So are they a presence there? Because they're huge here in Birmingham.
Yeah, there is a huge presence in Atlanta. I mean, they're large everywhere. So they're good at marketing. So if it depends on who you think to call. So do you think to call SurfPro? They've done a great job with marketing. They're getting that call.
Yeah.
But not everybody is thinking to call SurfPro. Some people will think to call, hey, I've got an issue. I'm going to call my State Farm agent. And my State Farm agent is going to tell me, hey, you really should work with these guys. So it comes back to relationships. So if we have relationships with all the State Farm guys, we'll get that work.
So right now, what you're working on, you've got Landex.
Yep.
You've got PuroClean.
Yep.
Those are the two main things. What am I missing?
Yeah, so I'm a hard money lender.
Yep.
What that means is I give people money that's backed by an asset.
Okay.
I have backed some businesses that are doing what's called fix and flip. So they'll buy a house, hopefully off market, hopefully reasonably below market value, because below market value for what it is, because there's got to be room.
Sure.
We improve it. We've got to make margin on that. So, I've helped, helped fund and advise on these are kind of small operations.
Yeah.
It's like 2, 3, 4 people operations. Since 2021, I think I've been involved in about 200 flip transactions.
Okay.
Where I'm funding the equity. There's a bank that funds the debt. Same thing. Same concept.
It's the same concept. So those three things are what you're doing right now. Anything else I'm missing?
There's probably stuff I'm forgetting about.
Yeah.
those are the main things that come to mind. So there, you know, within land, there's also, we've got a debt fund.
Yep. So Landex, I'm involved heavily in Landex as an investor. I've helped raise some money for it. I love Landex. You, JD Hill, who is absolutely wonderful, wonderful company. You've got where we invest dollars into a particular ranch. For example, Porter Ranch. We're trying to buy a ranch in Colorado called Porter Ranch. We're going to buy it. Have forced appreciation because it's 3,500 acres. We have forced appreciation.
Appreciation.
Forced appreciation where it goes from, let's just say $1,000 an acre. $1,000 an acre. We cut it up into smaller portions and it makes it to where it's $2,000 an acre. Those are arbitrary numbers, but you understand what I'm saying. It's like we explained before. It's kind of like Costco. You go to Costco, you buy a pack of 48 waters. It costs 25 cents a piece. You put them in a vending machine. You sell them for $1.50. Well, you could buy the big case of waters, and it's a better deal. But you don't need 48 waters. You need one.
You need one, and you're out and about, and you need one water. You don't think, I mean, it's more expensive to buy 48 in a pack, but you're on the corner, and you just want it.
You just want it right then. So,
you'll pay for the convenience of it already being what you want.
Exactly. So, you have a debt fund with Landex. Tell me what a debt fund is.
Sure. So a debt fund could mean many things, but I'll tell you what our debt fund means.
Yeah.
So we buy parcels of land.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the debt fund has multiple things. It mm-hmm. could be those hard money loans to real estate houses. It's less that. It's more focused on land. But it's first priority, which means we will either buy or lend where there's nobody ahead of us. When we're doing those subdivides, there's usually a bank that lends the first part of money. They get paid back first, investors get paid back second. In this scenario, there is no other money, so you get the return. Lower, both I think are great risk return. This is lower risk, lower return.
Right.
Because there's no, there's no money in front of you. So we'll pay anywhere from 9 to 12%, so call it 12% for money that people will give to us
yep.
to go, buy these plots of land or make these loans. And then in many cases, it'll be a quick flip, but our basis in this, we're buying it for, call it, 50, 60 cents on the dollar. So your money is super safe when you're doing that. And that's why the risk return. So we'll pay quarterly. So call it that 12%. So you put 100 grand in, you get a check every quarter for $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, we're allowing somebody who couldn't purchase this plot of land, they might not have another way to buy it. We'll in some cases owner finance it for 5 years as an example. And they're paying, we've raised money, we put our own money in it. So on top of this money you put in, we put in money that's call it second priority or
you
equity.
Put money in as well,
And that, this person who couldn't buy this plot of land now can buy it. They might, they might have just wanted the convenience to buy it from us. Number of reasons why, but they'll make their monthly payment to us and they'll buy this thing over, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 years.
Right. Why would someone invest in a debt fund?
Simple. So safe return, your money's safe. Predictable return. You invest 100 grand, let's say it's 12%, you get a $3,000 check or, even better than that, auto deposit show up in your bank account every single quarter.
Yeah.
So, and you don't have to worry because the loan to value on these things is typically pretty low.
Right.
A lot of stuff has to happen before the first dollar has any issue. Stock market, has high volatility, ups and downs. Not knocking the stock market. I do it.
Me and you both.
But if you know you're in a place where and 12% return compared to the average of the stock market, you're beating the stock market.
It's pretty good.
And it's consistent. Like the stock market might go up 20, might go down 25.
Right. Landex, PuroClean, two main things. The two main things. And you also do some hard money lending. There's a young business owner out there right now. There's an Aaron Shoemaker that's 21, 22, 23 years old. Tegan Cox, okay?
Just saying.
What would you tell them to do?
Work your butt off. Deliver value so far beyond what's expected without an expectation to someone that you know you need to be near.
Okay.
So be around people. I mean, if I could give myself advice as a, I literally wish I could go back to being 6 years old, knowing the path I'm on.
Yeah.
And I would give myself advice to learn money, learn business. Mm-hmm. And how do you learn business? You just work hard.
Yeah.
You work hard. You work in a business. Ideally, you know, maybe a diversity of two things. You're working, you're literally seeing everything and you're just busting your butt.
Yep.
You bust your butt and you deliver more value than you think you possibly could or could possibly be expected of you. Stuff happens.
Sure. How do you invest outside of the businesses that you own?
So, market.
Okay. Do you dollar cost average?
I should do a better job.
Okay.
I will.
Yeah.
I've chunk cost averaged.
Yeah.
Crypto.
Really?
We can talk about that more. I'll get the list out. Real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Small businesses.
Yep.
You know, hard money loans, fix and flip. So more real estate stuff. Haven't done much with multifamily, but I'm very excited about
the path we want to go down. Yeah,
path we've talked about.
Sure.
What's
a deal that you have lost a lot of money on?
Oh man. So just after you come into, you know, if you're sitting on a pile of money,
mm-hmm.
you feel like you've got to deploy that money.
Sure.
Not true. There are ways to earn money, a great return, you know, safe return, like we were talking about that debt fund.
Yeah.
Or stock market or whatever.
Like
a checking account.
Yeah.
You do not have to deploy a huge chunk of money. So I invested in this cannabis deal.
Hmm.
You know, within 6 months of our exit, we invested, I want to say it was close to $2 million.
Okay.
0% came back.
Not even
total write off. I might have gotten a check for $25,000.
$2 million, zero return. No return on capital.
It probably was a little less than that.
And, yeah.
You know.
Wow.
We
was it a knee jerk thing or was it?
No, it was well diligenced. It was
really. So what happened then?
It was a referral from a friend.
Okay.
It was well diligenced. Like I went out there, saw the operation, met with the guy. You know, did smaller chunks increasing. I did that too fast. So smaller chunks increasing over a like 4 or 5 month time period versus like a long time period. And it's unclear, but my belief is I just got burned.
Yeah. Last question. If you had to start over from zero today, what would you do?
If I had to start over and I could keep Sarah and Duck, and I literally have zero, I would find something I wanted to be a part of. So we've talked a lot about some of those things. Like if land is what I wanted to do, if buying a business is what I would want to do, I would, the same advice I would give to my 8-year-old self.
Mm-hmm.
I would surround myself with people who have already done it. I would find ways to add incredible amounts of value to them. And three things are happening there. You're getting direct experience with what you want to do.
Yeah.
You're learning from somebody who's already done it.
Yeah.
So both of those two are, you know, close relationships. And then just like alchemist things just happen.
Sure.
So paths open up and you start to see something. So if I start over again, like I'm not wired to be an employee.
Yeah, me neither.
So I know I would have to buy a business, start a business. So I would pick a path. And it, you know, in certain situations, like I might need cash flow too. So I would figure out, I might have to go take a job and, you know, take a W-2.
I think that's one of the most important things is people need to figure out, like, you got to live.
Yep.
You got to live. You don't need to take out huge amounts of debt in order to pay your grocery bill and pay your mortgage. Yep. Like, you got to live. So having a job while creating the thing is something, if you haven't done, everyone needs to experience. I did it in a way of, like, I immersed myself in coaching and worked 90 hours a week like you did at Goldman. I just didn't make any money.
Yep.
The amount of knowledge I had in those 2 years and really those 10 years is astronomical as far as football. It's probably more than most people ever. But, like, it is the 10,000-hour rule compressed into smaller and smaller amounts of time. It's not like working out an hour a day. It is like this much experience in this time. And having to do that and doing that, I think it changes your brain. I don't know the science behind it, but I think it changes your brain and it forces you to think differently.
100%.
About whatever it is you're doing.
100%.
And I think that everyone at some point needs to go through that hard thing.
Yep.
Does everybody need to work 100-hour weeks? I don't know. Maybe.
But it's not for everybody.
It's not. That's the thing.
It's not for everybody.
It is not for everybody. And the hardest thing that we can do, the worst thing we can do with employees and partners is to expect them to think and work like we do.
Not going to happen.
Spouses too.
Not going to happen.
Marriage advice. You can't expect. The worst thing that can happen in a marriage is unmet expectations. And us figuring out that the expectation part of every relationship that we have is going to get fractured at some point.
Yep.
And tempering those and loving whoever through that is incredibly important. Last thing. What's next?
What I'm doing now.
Yeah.
I don't know what will open up. I don't know what opportunities will just sort of appear.
Sure.
But I'm open to it.
Yeah.
Just open.
That's awesome. You're getting married in a month. Congratulations. It's going to be great.
Couple
months. So yeah,
by the time this comes out,
yeah. So.
But yeah, I've found my path, what that looks like in 5 years. You know, hopefully it's fun, compelling, exciting. And it's what I want to be doing.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Thomas.
Awesome.